We obtained the Einstein equation in the last lecture. This lecture we'll do that again, but we'll do it differently. We will now use the tetrad formulation of general relativity, where we will also see how general relativity is similar to so-called gauge theories in particle physics. Remember the tetrad formulation of differential geometry that we developed. We worked with so-called frames. And frames are arbitrary choices of basis vectors in the tangent spaces and in the cotangent spaces. So the E mu will be basis vectors in the tangent spaces, and the theta mu will be dual basis vectors in the cotangent spaces. And the point of choosing them arbitrarily is that we free ourselves from the canonical choice of bases that comes with a choice of coordinate system. The canonical choice being, of course, the choice of partial derivatives as the choice, the canonical choice of bases for the tangent spaces. You see, these are all particular directional derivatives, and then the dx mu's as their dual bases. We want to free ourselves from that particular choice because it makes things look like they change when they don't. For example, a tangent vector field really changes its coefficient functions only when we change bases in the tangent space. But we don't have to change bases in the tangent space just because we change coordinates. So we see more clearly what is really going on in the math and in the physics when we distinguish what is a free choice and what comes automatically. So remember that a vector field psi is always the same vector field no matter what choice of coordinate system, no matter what choice of basis you may want to make. So in one coordinate system, we may write it as some coefficient functions, xi mu of x, contracting the partial derivatives d by dx mu. In another coordinate system, the very same vector field would be described by some other coefficient functions, xi bar nu of x bar, these are the barred coordinates now, and d by dx bar nu. So this is exactly the same. The vector is always independent, of course, of the way that we express it in terms of coordinates. Since these direction vectors are not the same as those direction vectors, those coefficient functions are not the same, and of course, these direction vectors differ from those by a chain rule factor, and I spelled it out over here. So you can calculate how those coefficient functions depend on those coefficient functions if you choose your tangent, your basis in the tangent vector space to be always the one that comes with a coordinate system. But as we said, we are not doing this. We're going to choose now a fixed basis in the tangent spaces and the cotangent spaces, no matter what coordinate system. In this case, the same vector field psi that previously we wrote either this way or that way in a particular with whatever choice of coordinate system we may use. Now we will write that same vector field xi as some coefficient functions, xi mu tilde, multiplying our basis vectors in the tangent spaces. And now, since we hold that choice fixed, these coefficient functions are going to be exactly the same no matter what coordinate system. Those coefficient functions only change the moment we change bases, but not when we change coordinate system. We can choose to stick with the same coordinate system, but change bases in the tangent space. So that means that those coefficients will now change. The coefficients of our vector field will now change, even though we stick with the same coordinate system. For example, we may have chosen the thetas for our basis of the cotangent space, and then change our mind. And we say, okay, no longer we want to use the thetas, we want to use theta primes as our basis vectors in the cotangent space. These are going to be a linear combination of those, and there are going to be matrices, A mu nu, which are functions of X, that relate the new basis to the old basis. That's at every point. So this basis is position dependent. These are all functions of X, and so is this matrix A mu nu of X, because we can choose to change bases at different points in different ways. So these are just coefficient functions for changes of bases. This has nothing to do with tensors themselves, even though it has an upper and a lower index. This is a change of basis valued function. If this is how we change basis in the cotangent space, then the change of basis in the tangent space has to be such, or we choose it to be such, that we go from dual vectors to dual vectors. And that enforces that the transformation rule for going from the old basis of the E to the new basis of the E prime is such that we have the inverse of that matrix. It has to be invertible anyway, because a change of basis is always invertible, otherwise it's not a change of basis. So if we stick with the coordinate system, but we choose to change our choice of basis, then the very same vector field xi can now be written as a coefficient function, as the linear combination of the E mu, the old basis, with coefficient functions xi mu of x. But the old basis can be expressed in terms of the new basis of the E primes in this way, using this. Okay, I'm just throwing the A on the left-hand side. And in this way, I can express the E basis in terms of the E prime basis. Okay, so I'm writing the same vector field the old way. And then I express the old basis vectors in terms of the new basis vectors. And then I interpret this business here as the new coefficient functions. So I can read off that the coefficient functions change as I go from the old basis to the new basis, and they simply transform with the A matrix. So the basis vectors transform with the A inverse matrix in the tangent space, but the coefficients go with the A base, with the A matrix. And remember that all of these things depend on X. They're all functions of X. The same applies, of course, not only to tangent vectors, but also cotangent vectors and to tensors in general. So for example, the curvature two form, remember this is made out of the curvature tensor, which has four indices, but two of them we interpret as a form. And then there are two indices left over. Remember, the curvature gives us a 1-1 tensor valued two form. Okay, so this is the 1-1 tensor valued two form, curvature two form, where two indices are suppressed because we consider it to be a form, and two indices are left over. This is the tensor valuedness of the curvature form, and those two indices then transform as a contravariant and covariant index, just the same way that our tangent vectors and cotangent vectors do. So we have that the contravariant index transforms with an A, and the covariant index transforms with an A inverse. And remember what's going on here. We are not changing coordinate system. And yet, the curvature matrix valued function here is changing coefficients. It does because we are changing bases in the tangent and cotangent vector spaces. If, on the other hand, we choose to stick with the same basis of the E and the theta, and we change coordinate system, then the coefficients of our curvature tensor valued form are not changing. On the other hand, if we choose to change bases, then the connection one form, the omega mu nu, Which, if you remember, is related like this to the Christoffel symbols. Transforms, of course. It doesn't transform as a tensor because it is not a tensor. It transforms as usual. So the connection one form transforms in this way, which would be appropriate for a tensor, but there's also this homogeneous part, which, as we discussed earlier, indicates that it's not a tensor. This is the same formula that we had earlier when the A was a change of basis that arose because of change of coordinates. Now the change of basis is simply because we choose to change basis in a tangent and cotangent spaces. So all of this is pretty abstract, but we can make that completely explicit too. So how do we specify a frame? How do we make a choice of bases in the tangent spaces and cotangent spaces? Well, in an arbitrary coordinate system, we are automatically getting the canonical basis of the dxj as a basis in the cotangent space. We have it, even if we don't want to use it. But we have it, so we can express now our preferred choice of basis in the cotangent space in terms of the basis that comes along with the coordinate system. That's not the only way to do it, but it's one way to do it. So the dxj span the tangent space at every point, and here we have a change of basis matrix, which can vary in space, it's x dependent, and we get as output some other basis in the cotangent space if the A matrix is at every point invertible. What would be another possibility? I'm indicating that in here. Instead of choosing the dxj as basis, as basis vectors, another way to do it would be to choose four scalar functions, four arbitrary generic scalar functions. Let's call them f1, f2, f3, f4. Then the dx1 gives us a tangent vector at every point in space. The df2 will give us a tangent vector, it's a tangent vector field, a cotangent vector field. df3 is a cotangent vector field. The df4 is a cotangent vector field. And in general, at every point, those four cotangent vectors have no reason to be linearly dependent. In general, they will be linearly independent. You can choose them as a basis if you want. And so you could express your preferred choice of basis always as a linear combination of the df1, df2, df3, df4. Just have to be careful because occasionally they might be linearly dependent. In practice, this is the easiest way to do it. Choose your basis and express it as a linear combination of the basis that comes along with the coordinate system. Now, we use our freedom to choose the basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces wisely, of course. So we choose our basis to be orthonormal frames or so-called tetrads. And a tetrad is a choice of basis in the cotangent space such that the metric tensor actually takes the form of the eta matrix of special relativity, where it's minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So if you take the metric tensor and you plug in the new choice of basis in the tangent space, you get minus 1, 1, 1, 1 everywhere in space at once. We can also write it this way. The metric tensor is then minus theta naught, tensor theta naught. These are our preferred basis vectors. Remember that they always depend on x as well. I just didn't spell it out to keep the formulas shorter. Plus theta I tensor theta I. That's just another way of writing this. How did we convince ourselves that it's always possible to find a basis in the cotangent space, such that in that basis the metric takes the form of eta of special relativity? Well, we can do it because at every point in space, or in space-time, if you want to find such a basis, we simply construct a Riemann normal coordinate system around that point, around that event, and then the dx u that come with that Riemann normal coordinate system are at that point, at the origin of the Riemann normal coordinate system, they are the theta we are looking for. Because in a Riemann normal coordinate system, at the origin, the metric tensor is of the form of special relativity, just the minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And since we can do that everywhere, since we can build a Riemann normal coordinate system around every point of the manifold, we can identify at every point of the manifold a set of basis vectors in the cotangent space, which will diagonalize our metric and make it minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Is it unique, though? Is there just one way to get a diagonalization of the metric? No, it's actually not unique. Let's see, what are the transformations of bases that would preserve that property? That would preserve the property that the metric is of the form minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Well, I'm sure you've seen those transformations before. These are, by definition, the Lorentz transformations. So let's say the theta mu is a basis of a frame. So this is a basis of the cotangent space such that the metric takes the form of special relativity. Then we allow ourselves a change of basis to get a new basis in the cotangent spaces. And we ask, what conditions does this lambda have to obey to do this? Well, we need to have that the metric, when written in the old basis, remember this is by construction the metric written in the old basis, it's just theta a tensor theta b, and then the theta AB of special relativity, this also has to be the form that the metric is expressed in the new basis. If we now plug for theta prime for the new basis, this expression here, into that condition, then we obtain that lambda, lambda applied to eta is equal to eta. Just a condition that the metric tensor under those transformations stays the same. You know this condition, just not space-dependent, but space-independent, as the condition of Lorentz transformations in special relativity. So what we find is that transformations, changes of bases that get us from one frame, from one tetrad to another tetrad, are local Lorentz transformations. At every point in space and time, we are free to choose an arbitrary local Lorentz transformation. Of course, we choose it to vary in a smooth fashion so that, if necessary, we can differentiate with respect to it. But other than that, we can choose our Lorentz transformations completely arbitrarily. So the key message is that we can always find a basis that will diagonalize the metric, and that basis is not unique. It's unique only up to a local Lorentz transformation. Just also remember the interpretation of the connection in orthonormal frames. I think I mentioned it earlier, but it may be worth mentioning again. So the connection one forms, omega mu nu, are not tensor-valued one-forms. Remember what they are? They are basically the Christoffel symbols with one lower index suppressed, because one lower index we now consider to be a form, a one-form. So What do these one forms take their value in? Well, they take their value in something that has an upper index and a lower index, but we do know that it doesn't transform the way that a tensor would. So where do the connection one forms take their values in? It turns out that the connection one forms take their values in the set of infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. Let's start with the intuition and then let's do the math. So the intuition is this. What does the connection do anyway? The connection does infinitesimal parallel transport, right? But what does parallel transport do? Well, the connection one form has two indices. And one index is not shown. It's the index that we declare to be that of a form. So the form is expecting one tangent vector as input. It's the direction in which we want to parallel transport. So you choose a direction in which you want to parallel transport, plug that direction vector into the connection one form, and then you're left with a matrix value thing. What does that matrix do? Well, it does infinitesimal parallel transport in the direction that we've chosen. So it infinitesimally parallel transports vectors. But parallel transport means that it doesn't change angles. It means that it doesn't change lengths. So if you parallel transport two vectors and they have a particular angle before you parallel transport them, and then you parallel transport them, they may individually have rotated, but since both have been parallel transported, their relative angle should stay the same. And also the length should stay the same. So overall, what are these transformations that don't change angles, that don't change lengths? These are the Lorentz transformations, right? Because the Lorentz transformations preserve the metric. So they preserve the angles, they preserve the length. So infinitesimal parallel transport is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Therefore, the connection one form should be infinitesimal Lorentz transformation valued. You plug in a direction vector and out pops a matrix, and that matrix ought to be a matrix of an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Okay, let's quickly show that this is so. Lorentz transformations are linear maps which obey this condition here, which is the conservation of the metric. What about infinitesimal Lorentz transformations? Well, infinitesimal Lorentz transformations are almost the identity. So if I drop this term, the Lorentz transformation is just the identity. But we are looking at infinitesimal ones, so we are looking not at the identity itself, but small actual Lorentz transformation. So that's the identity plus an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Okay, a small Lorentz transformation is one which is the identity plus an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. And by that we mean concretely that we can neglect terms of order epsilon squared. See, in situations like this, the physicist's way of doing things is much less tedious than the mathematician's way, where you would talk about Taylor expansions and linear approximation and so on. Okay, so infinitesimal Lorentz transformations are these things here. What property do they have to obey if the whole thing obeys that? This is the defining equation of a Lorentz transformation. That's the infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. What equation do they have to obey? Well, let's just plug that thing into here. So we get that twice, right? We get the lambda substituted here and there, and we drop the terms that are of order epsilon squared. So we multiply these things out, drop the terms that are of order epsilon squared, and then what we obtain is one term where we have the identity multiplying the identity, equal to identity here, so that first term cancels. And then we have the term with epsilon times epsilon, that's epsilon squared. That term goes away because it's too small. And then we have two mixed terms. Here they are, equal to zero. It's equal to zero because the eta AB term canceled with the delta delta eta term, right? Okay, so this is the defining equation for infinitesimal Lorentz transformations for those guys. So any matrices epsilon nu b that obey that equation qualify as infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. If we lower the indices, after all, this is the metric, we are allowed to use it for what it does best, lowering indices. Then we can also write this equation in this way. So the infinitesimal Lorentz transformations with the lower indices have to be antisymmetric matrices. Yep?
Sorry, I'm probably just missing something. Why do the indices on the eta change in the line where it says IE? That
yeah.
Line? Yeah.
Okay, let's check them. So we have here eta mu, epsilon mu with eta mu, and then we have epsilon a. That should be a nu. Thank you, that should be a nu. And the other one is this one, nu b, eta. So that is all right, but those two. I see. Just a sec. It's because we have another one over here, right? So we have eta mu delta nu b. So that means that this eta nu becomes a b. That's how it works out. Okay, so what we just identified on this page is that infinitesimal Lorentz transformations are given in this way, where the eta mu a have to be antisymmetric when written with lower indices. So let us check. Are the connection one forms, which have two indices after all, one upper, one lower, are they infinitesimal Lorentz transformation valued? So in other words, if we take this thing and lower the index, do we get something antisymmetric? Okay, so here's the proposition, namely that this is really so. Let's quickly check that. Okay, so remember the absolute exterior derivative. The absolute exterior derivative acts on, just to remind you, acts on tensor-valued differential forms. And for the differential form part, it is the exterior derivative. For the tensor part, it's the covariant derivative. So if T is a tensor-valued differential form, then the absolute exterior derivative acts on it with an exterior derivation D that acts on the form part of it. And then we have those terms with the connection one form, which when you spell it out the old-fashioned way would be Christoffel symbols. So these are covariant derivatives that come with contractions of the contravariant and the covariant indices, such that for the contravariant indices you get a plus sign and for the covariant indices you get a minus sign. So that's true for any, that's by definition true for any tensor-valued form. In particular, we can choose as a tensor-valued form the metric tensor. Metric tensor is not much of a form. It's a twofold covariant tensor, but it's a zero form. So let's see. We have that the covariant derivative of the metric tensor is vanishing. This was the consistency condition between the affine connection and the metric. We can write this also as the total exterior derivative because it's a zero form. The G mu nu is a 0, 2 tensor valued zero form. So as far as the form part is concerned, there's nothing extra. If we now spell out, though, what this is, according to that expression, we have that it's this first term, d g mu nu, which is acting on the form part, but that doesn't do anything here because our g mu nu, if you remember, we are working with the frames now, is constant. It's always eta mu nu. So it's the first of a lot of simplifications that we get, namely that the d g mu nu, all of the partial derivatives of g mu nu, therefore, vanish. So that goes away. That was that first term over here. And then we get two of those terms with a minus sign for the covariant indices. So we get a contraction of the metric with the connection one form, one term where we contract with the first covariant index, and another term where we contract with the second covariant index. So overall, we can read this equation like this. 0 is equal to minus this minus that, which is to say that 0 is equal to this plus that. So we've just used here that the G can be used to lower those indices. Also, in principle, there's a wedge product here, because in principle, these are tensor-valued forms. But in this case, the metric is a 0 form, and 0 forms wedge other forms is just a multiplication. So that was just a quick, even though a bit abstract, way of showing that the omega mu nu for frames are really anti-symmetric, and therefore they really qualify as infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. The thing is a bit more messy when you work with coordinate bases, because coordinate bases generally are not orthonormal. Some vectors are longer, some vectors are shorter, they are not at any good angle to each other, so it's a little harder to identify then that parallel transport gives you infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. They do, of course, always, but in this case, it's easier to identify. Now we are at a point where we can see how general relativity is possesses a gauge principle. Now, I'm not sure if all of you are familiar with the gauge principle of particle physics. Who is familiar with the gauge principle of particle physics? One, two, three, a few of you, but certainly not all of you. So it's good that I sat down before class today and I wrote a little bit about that. Okay, so here is a quick review of the gauge principle in quantum mechanics. It can be done in quantum field theory too, but I thought I'd keep it easy and explain it just for quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, when you take a wave function, psi of x, it contains all of the information about the physics. If you change the wave function by multiplying it with a phase, e to the power I alpha, then you obtain a new wave function which contains exactly the same information. Nothing has changed. That's because all of the inner products between wave functions are left invariant, are staying the same if you apply to all of your wave functions a factor e to the power I alpha. That's because the psi 2 is going to change by a factor e I alpha, but the psi 1 also exposed to that will change by a factor of e to the power minus I alpha because of the star here. So those phase factors drop out in inner product. The same is true when you have expectation values of whatever polynomial you have in position and momentum operators. That's because those phases are just numbers, and when you spell it out, a phase over here will cancel with the inverse phase over there. Sorry, there needs to be a star over there. I'll fix that later. You can just commute the e to the power I alpha all the way over here, where it meets an e to the power minus I alpha, it goes away. So in other words, the physics is unchanged under these transformations. However, what happens if you do what is called local gauge transformations, as opposed to what this would be called. That's a global transformation. And that's a local transformation now, where I allow myself to change the phase from point to point. So let's say I take my wave functions and I multiply them with the phase e to the power I alpha of x times psi of x. If I do that, then the inner products will still stay unchanged, because e to the power I alpha of x meets an e to the power of minus I alpha of x from that wave function goes away. However, if I now calculate some expectation value in this way, or some matrix element, some polynomials in x and p, it doesn't strictly have to be polynomials in this business. You can also consider functions, but then you have to be a little bit careful. Let's just say they are polynomials. Well, then you can no longer be sure that this transformation won't do any harm. It could easily happen, and in general, it will happen, that this expression changes value when you do a local gauge transformation. That's because if you put here a factor of e to the power I alpha of x, and here a factor of e to the power minus I alpha of x, remember there's a minus sign because there ought to be a star, then in order to cancel those two factors, you would have to move that over here, but you can't, because the polynomial in the momenta has derivatives in it, and those derivatives will act on that prefactor here because it's now position dependent. So there will be extra terms, and the whole thing is just not invariant under these so-called gauge transformations. This leads to the question, can we change the theory? Can we rebuild quantum mechanics such that the physics is indeed the same, no matter what phase we multiply our wave functions with? It turns out you can do it, but there's a price to pay, a price that physicists are very happy to pay. Namely, you can make it invariant. You can make all those things invariant under those more general transformations if you pay the price that you introduce a new kind of field. And that new kind of field has to transform as well. As you use this to transform your wave functions, that new field also has to transform along the way. And then in total, these expressions will be invariant. And here's how you fix quantum mechanics. You fixed it by introducing a new kind of momentum. By changing what you mean by momentum. So instead of using the usual momentum operators, you introduce so-called canonical momenta. And the canonical momenta, I'm writing them as pi with the hat to indicate that they're operators, and then a superscript within brackets, a c for canonical. This is what it means. Sorry if it's not easy to read. Okay, so those new momenta, this canonical momenta, are minus ih bar, and then not the ordinary partial derivatives, but those capital D derivatives, so-called covariant derivatives. Namely, this covariant derivatives will be the ordinary partial derivatives plus, and this is the new field that I said needs to be introduced. So in addition to the wave functions psi of x, we now also have a new field a of x. In fact, it has components ai of x. All right, so far we've done a lot of things here. We've changed what we mean by momentum. Instead of minus I h bar d by dx, it's minus I h bar, and then it's this derivative, which has this additional term. But how does that help us? And how is that going to be related to general relativity? Remember our covariant derivatives. Our covariant derivatives look very similar. The covariant derivatives are the ordinary partial derivatives plus Christoffel symbols, or plus the affine connection. indeed the A will be an affine connection. The affine connection in general relativity describes gravity. The affine connection in this case will describe electromagnetism. So we start out with the Schrödinger wave function, psi, not knowing anything about the existence of electromagnetism. And the gauge principle motivates us to introduce these new momenta, the canonical momenta, with this covariant derivative and that new kind of field. And that new kind of field turns out to be just the kind of mass that's needed to describe electromagnetism. So how does it work? The proposition is that with these definitions, the inner product of wave functions stays the same under local transformations. Well, it did before too, right? The critical thing is that these expressions also stay the same under changes under local gauge transformations. So all I've done here is change the momentum to the canonical momentum. So this is superscript C. I know that's just a red speck over there, but it's meant to be open bracket C, close to bracket. Okay, so all we've done is we've put the momenta, we put the canonical momenta in there, which means when you spell it out, that you get the covariant derivative with the A field in it. And the claim is that these things are all staying exactly the same even when you do a local gauge transformation. So when you when you take your wave function and you change its phase locally with an arbitrary alpha of x, it needs to be differentiable, but other than that, any arbitrary alpha of x will do. If the newly introduced field A also transforms along with it, the A has to transform in such a way that A turns into A plus, no, sorry, minus d by dx I of alpha, where this is the alpha of the gauge transformation. Please try it out. Of course, you don't have to do it for a complicated polynomial. Just try for P itself. Check whether you get the same result before and after the gauge transformation. Now you might say, well, all right, that's all fine, but why all the trouble? Electromagnetism was known even before quantum mechanics. We don't need quantum mechanics to derive electromagnetism. We don't need quantum mechanics to derive the vector potential of electromagnetism. That is true, but this principle goes much deeper. This principle also applies for the other forces. Namely, what if instead of considering wave functions, psi, that are scalar, we look at wave functions that have an additional index, a so-called isospinner index, an additional index. So it's vector-valued wave functions. In this case, you can allow yourself to do gauge transformations that are not just phases, but that are complex 2x2 matrices. For example, unitary matrices. For example, unitary matrices with determinant 1. That would be SU2 transformation. So you see, you get much more complicated transformations then, where these things are matrix valued, 2x2 matrix valued functions of x. And then you can ask, can I still do this? And the answer is yes. You can still introduce an additional field. It would have more indices, two more indices, in fact. And it will have to have some complicated transformation properties, more complicated than this one. But then you have complete invariance again under arbitrary local, now unitary matrix valued transformations, gauge transformations. And you could ask, well, what is the physical role of that newly introduced field? The newly introduced field that you may call B or so, that compensates, just like electromagnetism, for these transformations, that would compensate for the matrix valued, 2x2 matrix valued gauge transformations. And that new field is the field that describes the weak interaction, that describes the W and Z bosons. with a bit of complications that was worked out, that were worked out by Weinberg. And then you can go on and you can say, well, what if I make that 3x3 matrices and I add to my wave functions an index that runs through three values? So I have three component vectors over there, 3x3 matrices over here. Then I get yet another field to be introduced, complicated transformation rules, and the momentum picks up more affine connections. But it can be done. And again, there is a force of nature that is described by that newly introduced field, and that's the strong force, the force between quarks, and you get QCD in this way. It doesn't seem to continue, though, if you go over to 4x4 matrices and 5x5, not for lack of trying, of course. No, it hasn't been successfully done. Of course, that's the aim of grand unified theories. They try to find a nice index structure here, nice matrix structure, nice group theoretic structure here that would include electromagnetism, the weak force, the strong force, and so on. Okay, but the point I want to make here is that we can locally change the vector representation of our wave functions. If this is, for example, a three-component vector, this is like a change of bases. If this is a 3x3 unitary matrix, it's simply a change of bases in your three-dimensional complex vector space in which your wave functions take their values. It's a local change of bases. Mathematically, pretty similar to the case of general relativity, where we also have local transformations that leave the theory invariant. In general relativity, it's the local Lorentz transformations. There's one key difference, though. This is all happening with so-called internal degrees of freedom, indices that are attached to your wave functions, and they are not, they could be running through 1 to 2 or 1 to 3, but these are not vectors that live in a tangent or cotangent space. These are not geometric vectors. These are purely what is called internal degrees of freedom. So they are neither covariant nor contravariant. These guys simply don't live in the tangent or cotangent spaces. As far as differential geometry, the differential geometry of space-time is concerned, they are completely scalar. They don't transform with a change of basis in a tangent and cotangent spaces. And correspondingly, you do get affine connections. So this thing is an affine connection over here. That's an affine connection, but it's not a metric affine connection. It's not that we get another metric for our space-time. This is purely internal. But still, the similarity is quite striking, I find. And of course, that similarity has motivated a lot of people to pursue quantum gravity on the basis of that similarity. But you see, it's not identical. It's not the same. It's just very similar. Yep. Yeah, that was a quick and dirty way. But remember that when we introduced differential geometry earlier in the course, we didn't introduce it this way, but we could have. We could have introduced covariant derivatives in just that way. We could have asked the following question. We want a derivative. How do we get a derivative, a generalized partial derivative, whose action commutes with the change of coordinates? And you would have found that that is possible. You can modify the partial derivative in such a way that if you first act with it and then change coordinates, or first change coordinate system and then act with it, you get the same result. Okay, just like we did here for the gauge transformations, right? If you do that, you find, yes, it's possible. You have to introduce a new field, though. Let's call it gamma. And it will turn out to be the Christoffel symbol. So you could do it the same quick and dirty way. And similarly, for gauge theories in particle physics, you can do it also the careful way that we did it for general relativity and differential geometry earlier in this course. This was just a quick way of doing it. And in fact, the intuition of parallel transport in that inner space of degrees of freedom, still carries on, carries forward in there as well. Yep.
So are we you're discounting the Arno Bohm effect. So how does that fit in with the previous treatment there? We are moving rather from global, not ignoring just the global, but the local phase as well.
The Aronoff-Bohm effect comes up here as the difference between exact and closed forms. And that can only happen if the space is not contractible. That would arise when, for example, you have a solenoid in the case of electromagnetism that is effectively punching a hole in your space-time. I think it would carry a little too far if we do that. Okay, so the message in reply to your question is that we discussed that the differential geometry has means to detect, so-called cohomological means, to detect whether the space-time has holes or handles, other non-trivial things. You can see it in the fact that not every closed form is exact. Not every differential form whose d is zero is the d of some other form. And that is true also for the differential geometry that arises from for the gauge theories in particle physics. And there it matters. It comes up quite a bit. Whereas in general relativity, I don't know of any evidence that space-time has a pretzel shape or has holes like that. Okay, so where are we here? Okay, so we can now pursue general relativity again, and we keep on the lookout for these similarities to gauge theories in quantum mechanics. Okay, so we want to do general relativity in a basis-independent way. For that purpose, let us redefine what the degrees of freedom of general relativity are. Remember, we can describe curvature through deficiency angles, through spectral geometry, through distances, the metric, and many other ways, affine connection, and so on. Let's say we start out with describing our space-time manifold as a differentiable manifold with a metric. It turns out it's completely equivalent to describe our space-time manifold as a differentiable manifold with a frame field on it. It turns out that if you know which basis vectors diagonalize the metric, then you know everything about the curvature of the manifold. You know everything about its shape. This may sound like a bit of a stretch. How come? You only know the basis that diagonalizes the metric, and then you know it everywhere? You do. Assume that the theta I are given explicitly. So let's say, for example, with respect to some basis that comes with the coordinate system. So somebody tells you, for this space-time, the following basis vectors, theta I of x, diagonalize the metric everywhere so that it is of the 4 minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So it's given explicitly to you, for example, through some matrix A mu nu that tells you how that wonderful basis that diagonalizes the metric is related to the basis that comes along with the coordinate system. So somebody gives you those functions A mu nu of x that relate the coordinate basis, which has no information in it, to the basis that diagonalizes the metric. So in that basis, the metric takes that form. Well, in that case, from that information, somebody just gives you that change of basis, those change of basis functions, A mu nu, then you can actually reconstruct the metric. How can we do that? The metric in the frame basis takes this form. It's the special relativistic eta mu nu, and then the basis vectors mu and nu as advertised. That's simply by construction, because it's a tetrad. But then that person who told you that this is a tetrad gave you that tetrad explicitly by assumption. So you know what these A mu nu coefficient functions are that relate the new basis to the coordinate basis. So So let's use that relationship and plug it in here. And then we get the eta mu nu that's just transcribed over here. And the theta can be expressed in terms of the dx. And that theta can be expressed in terms of the dx. And we get two factors of A. And what you see now is that the metric is in this way expressed as a linear combination of the basis vectors dx mu tensor dx nu with these coefficients. So what we can read off is that in the coordinate basis of the dx mu, the g mu nu, the matrix that describes the metric in that basis, is simply given by that. So this A turns out to be something like the square root of the metric. Okay, so given the A mu nu of x, you are given GAB. And therefore, you know all about the manifold, because from the G, you can calculate everything you like, Christoffel symbols, metric tensor, and so on. So therefore, everything follows from those A. Okay. Point of comparison now is this one. Remember, in quantum mechanics, the wave function carried all information about the physics. But if you multiply with the wave function with EI alpha, then not changing the physics. And we can even arrange it, and that's what makes particle physics a gauge theory. We can arrange the theory in such a way, with covariant derivatives, affine connections, and so on, that we can multiply our psi of x with arbitrary phases e to the power I alpha of x. And still, the theory will be giving us exactly the same prediction. All of the inner products, all of the matrix elements come out the same way. We said that if psi is actually vector valued, if it has these isospinner indices, then psi takes values in a complex vector space, like C2 or C3. And a gauge transformation in that case amounts to a change of basis in that complex vector space in which the psi takes values, C2 or C3. And we said that in particle physics, the theory is arranged in such a way, it's constructed in such a way, that we can locally change bases any which way we want, and it will not change the action or the equations of motion or the expectation values. The role of the psi is here played by the A. Remember that the A know everything about the physics. The A tell us everything about the metrics or this formula. And the A are not unique either, just like the psi is not. You can change with a phase or with a unitary matrix. And those phases and unitary matrices can be position dependent. Here too, what is the A again? Is it unique? Remember, that's what the A does. It maps from the coordinate basis that you may start with into your frame. Is it unique? No. It's not unique because the frame is not unique. If you choose an arbitrary frame and you apply a Lorentz transformation to it, you get another frame. Because Lorentz transformations will change the basis, but they keep the matrix representation of the metric the same. They leave eta invariant. So the A mu nu is actually only unique up to local Lorentz transformations. You can apply a global Lorentz transformation, but you can even allow yourself a local Lorentz transformation. It's just a change of basis in your tangent spaces such that a frame stays a frame. The metric stays of that form. And general relativity is built in such a way that, of course, it doesn't matter what basis you choose. And we know that we had to pay a price similar to the price that we paid in quantum mechanics. We had to introduce an affine connection. The partial derivative became the covariant derivative. And the affine connection describes not electromagnetism or the weak force or the strong force, it describes gravity. But then, even though it all sounds very similar, remember that this is external. And the other forces are related to internal degrees of freedom. Okay, so now let's move on and describe the Einstein action and the Einstein equations of motion, the Einstein equation itself, in terms of frames. So the theta I are the frames and are the frame bases. And all of the information is in the theta. Once we know them, that is to say, once we know the A, once we know the theta, we know everything about the physics, about the manifold. It should be possible to express everything, the action and the equations of motion, in terms of those theta. For that purpose, we need to express all the relevant quantities, such as the affine connection and the curvature tensor and the curvature scalar, all in terms of those theta. We know that from the theta we get the metric already because, well, of that equation which we just had up there in a box. But how do we get the other relevant quantities? For example, there were those crucial coefficients C, I, J, K of X. If you remember, those guys where what you use to express the affine connection and the curvature when you are working with a frame. How do we get those? Remember, the definition of the C was the following. If you take a frame and you take its exterior derivative, then what you get here is a two-form, right? Because this is a cotangent vector, so it's a one form. The d of it gives you a two form. And this being a two form, it can certainly be linearly expanded in terms of this basis of two forms. And those linear combination coefficients are by definition called the C. The nice thing about the C is that the C no longer refer back to the canonical basis of the dx mu's. Now, can we calculate those C? Well, we can, because see, if you can express the theta in terms of the dxj, then you can calculate the d theta. You will get a d of the a over here. You can explicitly evaluate that with partial derivatives. And you get a dxi, dxj, etc. And then you can change basis from the dxi, dxj basis to the theta I, theta j basis. And in this way, you can get those coefficients C. In the next lecture on Thursday, we'll actually do that for cosmological spacetimes, so that you can see all of this machinery at work. Okay, so from our initial information, the theta given through the A, we can obtain those matrix-valued functions, coefficient matrix-valued functions C, I, J, K of X. And then remember we had a formula a few lectures back that expressed the Christoffel symbols for arbitrary choice of bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces in terms of the metric and in terms of those coefficients C. That's a very general formula. If we actually work with a frame such that the metric tensor is always that of special relativity, I mean the representation of the metric tensor is always that of special relativity, then this thing simplifies dramatically because these terms here have partial derivatives of the metric in there. But if this is just the eta matrix of special relativity, then it's constant. So all of the lower line drops out. And we have only this upper line here, where these guys are very simple too, because they're just eta matrices. Okay, so we've gone one step further. We went from the A matrix to the theta, and the theta we were able to express in the C. From the C matrices, we can now calculate those Christoffel symbols. Then the Christoffel symbols give us the connection one form simply by interpreting one of the indices as the covariant index of a one form. So the connection one form is given by those two indices carried forward, and then the K index is viewed as the index of a one form. So we write it like that. You see, this is a one form that has still two indices left over. We now know what they do. This two index thing is a matrix, and that matrix is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So now we have, from our basic variables, the A and the theta, then we got the C matrix, then we got the Christoffel symbols, now we have the affine connection, everything expressed in those basic data. And now let's jump all the way to the metric tensor, or to the metric, the curvature tensor, or more precisely, the curvature two form. The curvature tensor, as you've seen it in the first course and a course on general relativity, has four indices, right? But when we work with a frame, then we interpret the curvature tensor as a two form, which is one tensor valued. Okay, so there's an upper index, a lower index, and it's a two form as well. Remember that these things don't transform when you change coordinate system. They transform when you change bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces, and that's up to you when you do that. Nothing to do with coordinate system changes. In order to go from the affine connection to the, or from the connection one form to the curvature two form, we can use this equation here, the second structure equation. Remember, the second structure equation is nothing deep. It's really just the definition of the curvature. Okay, we derived it from another definition of curvature, but you could also start with it. This is just the definition of, can view this as a definition of what the curvature two form is. It is this expression. That's the second structure equation. Do you remember what the first structure equation does? It defines the torsion, right? And in practice, we are setting the torsion equal to zero, so it's still an equation, but it arises from the definition of the torsion. All right, so the second structure equation gives us the curvature two form in terms of the connection one form. So the connection one form is a one form in particular. So the D applied to it makes it a two form, plus connection one form, wedge connection one form, that's a two form. And the index structure is such that this is having an upper and a lower index, just like this one. And here we contract, so we also have an upper and a lower index. Those things combine to give us here a tensorial structure. I've put here as a comment what the first structure equation gives us. The first structure equation says that the torsion is given by the total exterior derivative of the frame. That was the definition of the torsion. But since the torsion is vanishing, this whole equation is equal to zero. And when we work out what the total exterior derivative of the frame field is, it is, as far as the differential form part is concerned, the D. And as far as that index is concerned, we have a affine connection acting on it. So that equation sometimes is useful. Okay, so now we have expressed the curvature as well in terms of our basic variables. We have everything. So we can now express the action principle and the equations of motion and all of that in terms of our frames. So we will express everything in terms of the theta I of x, which, if you remember, is all the information you need to write down the metric, and therefore everything else. So here's the Einstein action written in the way that we had derived it earlier. We recognize here the volume form and the scalar, a zero form. Let's rewrite that more abstractly now. And I can do that the following way. Consider nu, which is a p-form. So let's say nu is an arbitrary p-form with these the coefficients. Then what is the Hodge star of it again? We will need the Hodge star quite a bit. So let me remind you of how the Hodge star operates. The Hodge star is a map from p-forms into n minus p-form. How does it do it? Well, here's our p-form. The Hodge star turns that into an n minus p-form by taking those coefficients, which of course are the coefficients of a p-fold covariant totally n-decimetric tensor. The Hodge star takes those coefficients and then raises them with a metric. So now we have something with indices all up. And then that resulting tensor, which has all upper indices, p of them, we plug into the volume form, which we can now do, right? Because the volume form expects contravariant indices, and it's getting p of them. So the volume form, which starts out being an n form, after having been fed p contravariant indices, has still n minus p covariant indices left over. And that's the output of the Hodge star. The Hodge star gives us an n minus p form. It's what's left over from the volume form, left over of the volume form after you fed it that thing with raised indices. So in particular, we get, because we are dealing with the volume form, the square root of g factor in this. That's interesting, because if we apply that star to a scalar, which is a zero form, then what we obtain as the output of the Hodge star is an n form. See, the Hodge star will map a p form into an n minus p form, and it will map a zero form, therefore, into an n form. And that n form is pretty much the same as the original scalar, except it picked up the square root of g from the volume form. So what we see here is that we can simplify that a little bit by simply expressing this thing as the star of R. That star of R is simply R times the square root of g. Okay, so that's a little simpler, but we still haven't achieved expressing the Einstein action in terms of our frame fields and the curvature tensor, the curvature 2 form that is expressed in terms of the frame fields. Now, if we did that totally straightforwardly, we would get an orgy of those terms, lots of thetas, plenty of them. For that purpose, it is therefore use and epsilon tensors, plenty, more than you want to work with. So it is useful, therefore, to make some definitions. And in the literature, that letter is used, and it's not an H. It's to be pronounced eta. It's the Greek capital eta. Okay? Just to make you familiar with the terminology in the literature. Okay, so the idea is we define a capital eta with indices alpha and beta. And what it is simply you take the wedge product of theta A and theta B, a combination that comes up a bit in what we do later on, and the Hodge star applied to that, which when you spell it out is this thing. Right? The Hodge star takes those things and makes them contravariant, plugs them into the volume form. So you get this. This is the remnant of the volume form here. and the 1/2 is one of those combinatorial factors. So in order not to have to write all of this all the time, let's just call it eta alpha beta. If we take three of the frame fields with wet products, and we apply the hot star to that, this is also something that comes up when you do general relativity in the frame formalism, then that's this expression over here. Again, this is left over from the volume form after you've made these things contravariant and plugged them into the volume form. That thing will be called eta with three indices. It has three indices, three lower indices, and it is a one form. Okay, it's a one form. It has three lower indices. So it is technically a 0-3 tensor valued one form. And that thing is what? As a form, it's a two form. It has two lower indices. So it is a 0-2 tensor valued two form. Okay, so now the proposition is that the hot star of R, which, if you remember, is the Lagrangian density of general relativity, the thing that we have to integrate over. Remember, this whole thing is an n form because R is a zero form. Proposition is that this hot star R is the wedge product between the curvature two form and this eta with the two indices there, and the indices contracted, so that the whole thing is scalar valued. It's a scalar valued four form. So this is a curvature two form. This thing we just said is a two form. Therefore, the whole thing is a four form, and therefore, as it should be, matches the four form character of this, something that can be integrated over. And it is 0-0 tensor valued. It's scalar valued because those indices are being contracted. If that's so, we'll have to prove that proposition. If that's so, then the Einstein action in terms of the frame fields can be expressed in this way. We replace the star R by the eta mu nu veg omega mu nu. Okay, let's prove this. First, we use that the curvature two form can be expressed in terms of the curvature tensor, in terms of the Riemann curvature tensor in this way. We had this in an earlier lecture. Now, what comes up in the action is the wedge product of H mu nu with the curvature two form. So, remember, it's this combination that we have to work out. So that combination can be written in this way, where we've spelled out what the omega is in this way with the Riemann curvature tensor and two thetas, Riemann curvature tensor and two thetas. And then the H mu nu we also spelled out. Remember, the H mu nu is the star of theta mu, theta nu, which gives you two thetas, wedge product of two thetas, but also a square root of g and an epsilon tensor. The square root of g we can drop here because the square root of g is always 1. We're dealing with frames after all. We just kept track of it earlier to make sure we see where what comes from. But in practice, since we choose our metric to be -1, 1, 1, 1, the square root of g is always 1. Okay, so we get this lengthy expression here. And sometimes it's not avoidable, but we'll have to work with multiple epsilon tensors. If we spell out what this wedge product of four basis vectors is, it's epsilon tensor contracted with those basis vectors now with tensor products. Remember, the wedge product is the anti-symmetric tensor product. So when we plug that in here, we get that this epsilon tensor is being contracted with that epsilon tensor. At least the gamma delta indices are. But when you have the product of two epsilon tensors contracted over the last two and the first two indices, then, and it's no fun to try to prove this, it's just very tedious, then you have this identity for them. If you plug that identity up here in this lengthy expression, you get that result. And that is, of course, just the Ricci scalar, and that's our four form. Square root of g is 1. So overall, this is what we had to show. This is star r. This is the action. So the Einstein action in the frame formalism is given by that expression here. But how about the equations of motion? In order to derive the equations of motion as a preparation, let's just quickly prove this statement, because that will come up later on and it would be disturbing the flow of the argument if we did it then. Consider the eta mu nu. Remember, that's the star of theta mu veg theta nu. Proposition is that the total exterior derivative of that thing is equal to 0. Let's spell it out. The d applied to eta mu nu is the d of that. This is the star of theta mu theta nu. The star produces the square root of g, which is 1, and an epsilon tensor. That thing is constant anyway. The epsilon is constant, so we are not getting any contributions from differentiating this. Therefore, the d only has to act on the thetas. But that's vanishing as well. When you apply the total exterior derivative on the frame field, that is equal to 0. Do you remember where that comes from? The total exterior derivative on the theta is equal to 0. It comes from the definition of the torsion. That's the definition of the torsion. It's the first structure equation. It says that the torsion is the total exterior derivative of the frame field. And since the torsion is vanishing, that is vanishing. Since we assume the torsion to vanish, we assume that this vanishes. Therefore, the whole thing collapses. It's just 0. OK, so we keep in mind the capital D applied to the h mu nu is equal to 0. Let me just remind you of all of those crucial identities that we are using here, just so that you have them all in one place. Because I know it's pretty tough to remember them all. The first two are the so-called structure equations. They sound as if they are terribly important. They are important, but they really don't carry much information because they can be viewed as definitions rather than theorems that need to be proven. The first structure equation tells us what the torsion is. The torsion is equal to, by definition, the exterior derivative, the total exterior derivative of the frame field, which, when spelled out, according to the definition of what the total exterior derivative is, it is this, which is 0, because we assume the torsion to vanish. Right? Remember, the total exterior derivative will act as the exterior derivative on differential form parts, so it will take the d of it, but it also has an upper index, and that is a tensorial part. And that will be dealt with the covariant derivative, which is to say with an affine connection. The second structure equation is the definition of the curvature 2 form. Curvature 2 form is defined in this way. And then we had the Bianchi identities that arose from the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory. And the first Bianchi identity said that when you take the curvature 2 form, wedge it with a frame field, contract over that index, you get equal to 0. And the second Bianchi identity says that the total exterior derivative of the curvature 2 form is vanishing. Also, we showed today that when we work with orthonormal frames, then the connection 1 form is anti-symmetric in the lower indices, which meant that it generates infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. Okay, so these are the tools that we can use. Here's the main proposition. We want to calculate the variation of the Einstein action. So we want to vary with respect to the frame fields, which means that we have to vary the argument in the Einstein action, the star R, which is to say that we have to vary the, let me show you where it is again. Here it is. We want to vary the Einstein action with respect to the frame field, so we have to vary these two terms with respect to the frame field. Here's the main proposition. The main proposition, which we will prove later on, is that when we vary the Einstein action, we get this type of answer. We get the variation of the frame field, veg this eta, which is the star of the frame field, veg the curvature 2 form, plus the d of something. A d of something you want to see. Because under the integral, that's a boundary term, it's going to go away. Because we vary, we don't vary the frame field at the boundary or outside of the boundary. So if that's so, if that main proposition holds, then that implies that the variation of the Einstein action is this, plus, as we said, the d of something integrated, which is the same as leaving out the d and integrating over the boundary. But at the boundary, we have the variation vanish. So the boundary term goes away via Stokes. So only that part survives from varying the Einstein action. Now, the action also has matter fields in it. There's going to be electromagnetic fields. There's going to be stars and dust and all sorts of things. They will produce, they are described by an action, the matter action, and we also have to vary the matter action with respect to the frame fields. Just like earlier, we varied the action with respect to the metric. We varied the Einstein action with respect to the metric, but we also varied the matter action with respect to the metric. The total action had to be varied with respect to the metric. And that variation was set equal to zero, and that gave us the Einstein equation. Here too, we take the total action, the gravitational action plus the matter action, and set the variation with respect to the frame field equal to zero. So the matter action, we also vary with respect to the frame field, and our definition is going to be that we have an energy momentum one form, T mu, which is defined to be whatever is needed to make that equation right. So this is a short way of expressing how we defined variational derivatives earlier. So it's the delta theta mu times something, and that something was the derivative of the action with respect to the frame field. So overall, when we vary the total action, the S gravity plus the S matter, we get this plus that. And that has to vanish for all variations. So we get the Einstein equation that this is equal to that. Namely, we get that the variation of the Einstein action plus the matter action with respect to the frame field equal to zero means that the equation in the box holds, which is that, you know, these terms plus those terms equal to zero. And that's the Einstein equation in terms of frames. Not necessarily much prettier than the way we had the Einstein equation earlier. But remember that there is a benefit we get from doing it so abstractly. Like the square root of g is always 1. The metric is always, the metric tensor is always represented as eta. And if you change coordinates, you don't have to change those matrices at all. Then if we give this thing a name and call it the Einstein form, Remember, it has one lower index over there. And so if we define g mu as the 0, 1 tensor valued 1 form, namely this expression here, such that the star g just gives us this left-hand side over here, then we have a star g over here and a star t over there. Applying the Hodge star on both sides gets rid of the Hodge star, because the Hodge star is an involution. Applying it twice, you get the same thing as what you started with, up to possibly a minus sign. So therefore, we obtain then that on the left-hand side, we have the Einstein tensor, and on the right-hand side, we have the energy-momentum tensor. Or we have the Einstein 0-1 valued one form and the energy-momentum tensor 0-1 valued one form. Where under change of coordinates now, these things don't change their entries. And they are differential one forms. Well, and in the next lecture on Thursday, we will actually go through this process in explicitly. In fact, well, we do it for cosmology, and the cosmological case is so simple that we won't even get as far as that, because we will be able to read off what the solutions are at an earlier stage already. But we will go through the process of identifying a frame field and expressing the affine connection, the connection one form, and all those things in terms of those basic variables. And then we can solve for the dynamics of space-time under the assumption of spatial homogeneity. Right, so now I have two more pages, but those pages are the proof of that proposition earlier. Namely, that the variation of the star of R can be written in this form. It's maybe a little tedious and maybe a little late for that now. So I leave it up to you to read that in your own time. And if you get stuck at any point, let me know and I'd be happy to explain it. Yep.
What is the Palatini variation in this language, frame fields and stuff?
Let me get back to you on that. I don't want to say anything wrong there. Let me have a look into that again, and I can tell you that. Any other questions? Okay, see you on Thursday.